It was one of those weekends that lined up just right, rare as a blue moon. Both of us, me and Riley, had a Friday night through Monday off, no work, no errands, nothing pulling us in 10 different directions. We weren't planning on anything big, but when I saw the block of days open and a decent Airbnb pop up just a few hours away, we booked it without thinking too hard. That was still very early on in the stretch of our relationship, when impulse stuff felt like magic, everything was new, every plan was exciting. You just wanted to be next to each other, no matter where that was. The place was just over the state line, a little town near a river with a long name that I couldn't pronounce and didn't even try to. A bunch of antique stores, local breweries, a lake that was more like a big pond, and hiking trails that we had no intention of using. I picked that Airbnb because it looked like something out of a furniture catalog, clean, bright, and modern. The photos showed a wide open floor plan, a clawfoot tub in the bathroom, one of those long wooden dining tables you never actually use. It had this cozy look to it, and Riley's eyes lit up when I showed it to her. All she said was, "Let's go." We hit the road Friday morning, coffee in hand and bags tossed into the trunk. It took us 3.5 hours to get there. The check-in instructions were easy enough. Keypad lock, 4-digit code, and then the door swung open without a hitch. The second we stepped inside, Riley said, "Babe, this place is gorgeous." And she wasn't wrong. It smelled like pine cleaner and candle wax, like somebody had just vacuumed and lit a fresh wick. Everything was spotless. The windows let in this big, soft light that made the whole place glow. It literally felt brand new, even though it probably wasn't. We dumped our stuff in the bedroom and did that classic couple walkthrough, wooing and awing over dumb things like throw pillows and little jars of oatmeal the host had left on the counter. It had that energy of a fresh start, like nobody had ever stayed there before, and we were the first ones to christen it. It felt like ours for the weekend. There's nothing off, nothing weird, no weird smells, no creaky in the floors, no creepy dolls in the closet. Just a nice house in a sleepy town, a getaway, a full reset for us. I had no reason to think that the most disgusting night of my life was only a few hours away. We dropped our stuff off and then hit the town, walked hand in hand down that main strip, popping into shops with handmade signs and dusty old displays. Riley tried on rings at some little boutique that smelled like incense and cat hair. I bought a stupid wooden spoon that I didn't need just to support the guy who carved it. We hit a tap room around 3 and shared a flight of local beers, laughing at the one that tasted like battery acid. Just being together, that was the whole point, right? Dinner was unreal. We found the steakhouse tucked in the corner of a strip center that looked like it hadn't been renovated since 1997. You'd never expect it to be this good, but inside, white linen, polished silverware, and one of those menus that has a few things on it, but you know they're all killer. Escargot, garlic bread, wedge salad, soup, steak, and lobster. Creme brulee to split it off. Riley toasted her wine glass against mine and said, "This might be the best date of my life." I felt the same way, stuffed and smitten. We Ubered back tipsy and giddy, and were already pawing at each other in the driveway. The wine continued to flow once we got inside, and we made our way to the bedroom like we were the only two people in the world. It was perfect. That kind of intimacy when you're totally locked in, no nerves, no distance, just skin on skin and warm laughter under the sheets. I fell asleep with her hand in mine, her breath slow against my shoulder, and I remember thinking to myself, yeah, I could do this forever. I think it was around 3 or 4 in the morning when I woke up needing to piss. I tried to slip out of bed without waking her. The house was dead quiet. I padded barefoot down the hall, still half asleep, and right away, I felt something wrong. The floor was weird. Not wet, not sticky, but soft. Like the carpet had a layer underneath it that had shifted slightly under each step. I stopped, flexing against the pile, and sniffed. Something reeked, like sweet rot, like meat left in the sun. I squinted into the dark. No sound, just the house breathing around me. I reached the bathroom and turned the light on. I did my business and tried to shake off that queasy feeling rising up in my gut. When I turned to wash my hands, I caught sight of the hallway in the mirror behind me. The floor was moving. At first, it looked like static, just a rippling effect in the low light, but when I stepped out and knelt down for a closer look, my stomach lurched. Maggots, thousands of them, writhing in this thick, slow-moving trail that led from the base of the garage door, across the hall, and then toward the kitchen. They were clumped like wet rice, squirming in and over each other, making the carpet buckle and writhe under the weight. I gagged, stumbled back. My bare foot had been stuck to it. I wiped them off the tile, trying not to throw up in the process, and then I ran back to the bedroom. "Riley, babe, you gotta wake up now." She groaned and rolled over. "What time is it?" "I don't know, just wake up, seriously." Her eyes blinked open and I pulled her up by the shoulders. "Something's wrong, there's maggots in the house." And that woke her up. We both stood in the hallway wearing nothing but underwear and horror. She clapped a hand over her mouth. "What the fuck?" "They're coming from under the garage door," I said. "I don't know how, I don't know why, but it reeks. Something is dead in there." "Jesus Christ," she whispered. We ran back to the bedroom, yanked on jeans and shoes, and threw shirts over our heads without bothering to match. Riley grabbed her phone and turned on the flashlight. I armed myself with a broom by the fridge. "I gotta see what it is," I said to her. "Are you serious?" I know it doesn't make sense, but I need to know." She didn't argue with me. We turned on every light as we passed, following the trail. The smell got worse with every step, a thick, putrid stench that clung to the back of your throat. I used the broom handle to nudge the garage door open. It groaned as it lifted a few inches, enough for more maggots to spill through like water from a dam. I reached inside and flipped the light on. Riley gasped and I dropped the broom. In the middle of the garage, piled up in a corner like garbage, were three dead animals. Two raccoons, bloated and rotting, their fur sloughing off in patches. One of them had a paw frozen mid-reach, stiff and mummified. Next to them was a dog, medium-sized, golden coat, flies buzzing around its blackened eyes. The mouth was open in this silent, permanent scream. The floor around them was soaked with decomposition fluid, the source of the stench, the breeding ground for all those maggots. "I think they got in and then couldn't get out," I said, covering my nose. "Why wouldn't anybody clean this up?" Riley responded. "Why would the host leave like this?" I don't know. "Why didn't we smell this before?" And that question stopped me right in my tracks. She was right. How did the stench not show up earlier? If those animals had been in there for more than a day or two, that smell would have been pouring through the vents. I looked again. The bodies weren't lying naturally. They were in this rough semicircle. One of the raccoons had a piece of red twine tied around its neck. There was this weird scorch mark on the concrete too, black ash in a spiral. I didn't say anything as I looked. Riley pulled me back toward the door. "We need to call someone." "I already tried," I said. "No response from the company, it's the middle of the night." She was shaking. "We can't stay here." I nodded, but we had no idea where else to go. We sealed off the garage the best we could. I shoveled towards the door frame and pushed a chair up against it like that would matter, and stuffed the vents in the laundry room with pillowcases. Then we stepped outside, barefoot in the driveway, and opened the garage from the outside. The overhead door groaned up slowly. Then came with it a new wave of stink, thick and rotten. Maggots then spilled onto the concrete like soap suds from a busted washer. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. It just felt like it was better to let the filth go out and not further inside the house. We grabbed all our stuff, every last item, and loaded the car. I stripped the sheets off the bed in case anything had crawled into them. Riley pulled her hoodie on tight and muttered that she still felt like they were on her skin, even though we never stepped foot inside the garage. I think we were in the shower for over an hour, hot as we could take it. Steam filled the little bathroom, fogged the mirror, and scolded the ghosts off us. I scrubbed like I was trying to remove a layer of my skin. Riley didn't talk much. She just stared at the wall and cried softly, water running down her cheeks like it didn't belong there. At around 6 a.m., I finally got a call back, but not from Airbnb. It was the owner.
"Hey,"
he said, tired and groggy.
"I got a message about something going on in the house."
I explained everything to him. The maggots, the animals, the stench. There was this long pause on the other end, and then he said,
That don't make any sense. I don't know how anything would have gotten in there. I was just in the garage last weekend. It was perfectly clean."
We didn't argue because there wasn't a point. When he arrived later that morning, Riley refused to go back inside. I followed him into the garage more out of morbid curiosity than anything else. He froze when he saw the bodies, then he noticed the twine, the ash, and that semicircle. At first, he didn't say anything. Then he muttered, almost to himself more than anybody, "Why does this look kind of like a ritual?" I don't know what I really told myself after this. I said maybe he was wrong, told myself that we were just in the wrong place at the wrong time kind of thing. But we boogied the fuck out of there after that and wanted nothing to do with the owner's wild theories that came afterwards. In our minds, some animals got stuck in the garage, couldn't get out, died and decomposed. That's all. No kind of seance, no ritual, because I can't bear the thought. This was back when Airbnb was still raw, before cleaning fees into hidden cameras, when most listings were just extra rooms inside somebody's house. I was backpacking across Europe, trying to see as much of it as I could before reality would reel me back in. Hostels were cheap, sure, but I'd already had my fill of snoring strangers and bedbug rumors, so I started booking spare bedrooms on Airbnb. Locals offering up their flats, usually a guest room or a fold-out couch. It felt more grounded, like you were borrowing space from somebody who'd pour you a glass of wine and show you the good bakery. Not just a front desk clerk handing over a key. I was in France when this happened, some small town in the northern half. Honestly, I don't even remember the name. I wasn't being choosy. I'd take a train as far as my budget would stretch, find a town with character, stay a night or two, and then move on. This one had cobblestone streets, crooked little alleys, and not a single word of English on any street signs. That's how I knew it was going to be good. The listing was for Chambre privée dans maison familiale, a private room in a family home. A couple who owned the place had emailed me once or twice in broken English. Their photos looked warm and inviting. The woman, Elise, was in most of them. Middle-aged, blonde, red lipstick, even when she was in the kitchen. The man, Jacques, looked quieter, softer, and had glasses and a thinning hairline. They confirmed everything with a thumbs-up emoji and said they'd be home by 4. I spent most of that day walking the town, the cathedral, local shops, this weird flea market where I bought rusted corkscrews for absolutely no reason. I checked in around 5. Their place was tucked behind a bakery, down this narrow alley. 2 stories, shutters on the windows, ivy climbing the wall. Jacques opened up the door and welcomed me like I was his nephew. Elise kissed both cheeks and then handed me a glass of wine before I'd even set my bag down. The place smelled like butter and lavender. It felt authentic, cozy, real. At the time, I thought I'd stumbled upon one of those golden experiences travelers always brag about. But I was wrong. The room was simple. Wooden floors, a twin bed, a little desk with a lamp, and a window that opened up toward the alley. No locks on the doors, which kind of struck me as odd, but I figured this was one of those trust-based countries. A handwritten note on the nightstand said, "Buena vie. Please join us for aperitif at 6, with a little smiley face next to it. I washed up, changed my shirt, and came out right at 6. The living room smelled even stronger now. Cheese, fresh baguettes, maybe some kind of cured meat as well. Jacques was pouring wine into huge glasses and Elise was lighting candles on the table, like she was prepping for a date of her own. "You like rosé?" she asked. Her English was heavily accented, but clear enough. "We only open this for special guests." Jacques smiled at that, but didn't say much. We sat around the table and started drinking. I remember thinking how much better this was than some sticky hostel lounge. They laid out this giant spread. Brie, roquefort, salami, prosciutto, little slices of apples and strawberries. Elise continued to refill my glass constantly, clinking hers against mine and laughing the whole time. Shock seemed to drink slower but still kept pace, his eyes bouncing between the two of us. The conversation was normal at first. Where'd I been? Where I was headed? How long I planned to travel? But as the wine kept coming, Elise got looser. She started asking much more personal questions. Do I have a girlfriend? Was I lonely traveling all by myself? Did American women really look like the girls on Friends? At first, I found it funny. I laughed it off, but somewhere around the third or fourth glass, the tone had now shifted. She leaned a lot closer when she spoke. Her hand brushed mine more than once. Her blouse was loose, and it started to slide off on one shoulder. Wow. She poured her next glass sloppily, dribbling pink wine down her wrist and then licked it up like it was nothing. Jacques was watching all of this, silent, his smile thinning out. I think I'm gonna turn in soon, I said, half standing. Oh, don't go yet, Elise pouted. It's only getting interesting. I'm pretty tired. She scowled at me for just a moment, then smiled again, but it didn't reach her eyes. I stood fully, took a step back from the table, and that's when it all fell apart. What is it? She snapped. Do you not like French women? No, I just... Is it because I'm old? She barked at me. Standing up so fast, her chair screeched behind her. You think you're too good for me, huh, American boy? Elise, Jacques said gently. Shut up, she yelled, rounding the table. I backed up with my hands raised, trying to calm the situation down, but she came at me fast, wild-eyed and snarling, and whacked me across the head with her high heel. I stumbled back and caught the wall. The point of the heel caught me just behind the ear, not enough to bleed, but sharp enough to make me reel back. Elise, Jacques shouted, grabbing her shoulder. But she kept trying to claw at me, screaming in a mix of French and English. Something about Americans, about how we think we're better than everybody. About how I was just a boy playing at being a man. Jacques pulled her back, trying to hold her arms down, but she thrashed and thrashed, and nearly knocked over the table. Go! Jacques yelled at me. Just pack up and just go. You need to go. I didn't argue. I went straight to the room, half drunk, heart hammering, and started shoving everything I owned into my bag. I wasn't even thinking about where I'd go, I just couldn't stay here. Outside the door, I could hear her sobbing, then shouting, then something crashing, glass, maybe a plate. I zipped up my bag and opened up the door. Jacques stood in the hall, red-faced and sweating. He didn't say anything, just moved aside to let me pass. Elise was in the kitchen, wine-soaked and slumped in a chair, and she hissed when she saw me. You're trash, she spat at me. Trash tourist. I hope the police find you. I just kept walking. I stepped outside the front door and something wet hit my back. I turned and she'd thrown her wine glass at me. It bounced off the door frame and shattered in the alley. Jacques pulled her back again, muttering something like, enough, enough. I kept going though, and the door slammed behind me. Now, I was alone, drunk, and completely without a place to sleep. It was nearly midnight. The town was dead quiet except for the occasional hum of a scooter or the rattling of a passing train. I had no plan, no backup, just the weight of my pack and a buzzing paranoia that made me check over my shoulder. That police thing had stuck in my head, though. She said it like she wanted them to come after me. Had she already made up some kind of story? Was I going to be wandering around some foreign town only to get nabbed by the police for assaulting her or something? I ducked into a side street and stayed there for a few minutes, crouched low, just watching. Nothing happened, no sirens, no shouting, but still, I felt like I was being hunted. I made my way into the city center, the plaza, the clock tower, and stone benches. There was one place that still had lights on, a hostel tucked between a pastry shop and what looked like some kind of used bookstore. The desk clerk barely even looked up when I came in, and I asked if they had any beds. He pointed at a clipboard. I signed it, paid in cash, and got a key for the top bunk in room 6. There were 4 people already asleep in there, and I didn't bother changing my clothes, just climbed up and laid there in the dark. every creak in the building sounding like a footstep coming right for me. I didn't sleep much. I left just after sunrise, before the other travelers could even stir. My pack wasn't fully zipped and my shoes were still damp from the night air, but I didn't care. I wanted out of that town. I didn't even stop for coffee, just made a beeline for the train station with my hood up and my eyes down, half expecting to see a police car pull up beside me at any second. But thankfully, nothing happened. No sirens, no glares, nobody called my name, nobody stopped me at the station. I bought a one-way ticket to the next major stop in the direction of Belgium and didn't look back. When I boarded, the cabin was nearly empty. I sat by the window and watched the town vanish into the trees. I guess part of me wanted to believe that maybe I overreacted, that Elise had just had far too much to drink and Jacques was in over his head with a woman who clearly had a switchblade for a temper. But the other part of me, the one that had been sober enough to feel how fast things went sideways, knew a lot better. That kind of rage just doesn't come out of nowhere. That kind of threat doesn't dissolve just because you walk out the door. I don't know if she ever called the cops or if Jacques talked her down after I left. I don't know if I dodged something worse by 30 seconds or if I'd just been a convenient lightning rod for a woman used to burning everything around her. What I do know is this though, I never booked another Airbnb for the rest of that trip. Not in Spain, not in Germany, not even when I got to the Netherlands, where everything seemed to be like a postcard. I stuck to hostels, loud, gross, and personal hostels. I take the bunk above a snoring Australian over a shared wine glass with strangers any day. People talk about those authentic experiences when they travel. They say you should get out of your comfort zone, lean into the culture, say yes more than you say no. But that night taught me something else. I think sometimes comfort zones exist for a good reason.
This was in the early 2000s, and the exact reason I was driving that night escapes me now. But one autumn night at around 8 p.m. when it was already dark, I took a right turn off the main highway. It was a small neighborhood nestled between two cities of about 100,000 people each. The rain was coming down hard, and my wipers were on medium. I wasn't in a hurry, just driving, when I came around a bend in the road to a neighborhood with maybe 40 houses, a small cul-de-sac development. I remember approaching the bend and seeing a woman. She was about 20 feet ahead, standing at the end of a driveway, lit up by my headlights. She was wearing a tank top and jeans, her arms crossed tight around herself like she was trying to warm up. She was staring directly at me, not the car, but at me. I wasn't sure what to make of it, but my first thought was that she needed help. I was young, just trying to be a good guy, so I slowed down and rolled down my passenger side window. My car didn't have power windows, so I had to lean over and crank it down. She could see that I had to roll it down, and as I opened it just a few inches, she did something strange. She reached out with her hand and grabbed the top of the window, her fingers coming so close to my face that it startled me. At first, I didn't know what to think. I had asked if she was okay, but she didn't answer. I could see her face now. She was young, probably 18 to 22, her eyes red from crying, and her breath coming in gasps between sobs. I asked again, "Are you all right? Is everything okay?" She didn't respond, and she didn't even move. She just kept staring at me, tears streaming down her face, her fingers still gripping at the top of the window. The silence between us felt heavy. It was like she was in a different world, not hearing me, not even acknowledging that I was there. I thought that maybe she was just in shock, and maybe she needed help more than I could understand. So I offered her a ride, thinking that I could take her somewhere, help her out, but she didn't react. Not even a nod, she just kept crying, staring right at me. I felt like I was in a staring contest with someone who had lost their own mind. I don't know how long I sat there, but it felt like forever. I glanced down the road ahead, not sure what to do. Then I looked back at her, and something shifted inside me. I didn't know what was going on with her, but something about the whole thing felt wrong, like I was supposed to walk away. The tension in the air was too thick, and fear started creeping into my body. I said I was sorry, though I wasn't sure why I was apologizing, and before driving away I said, "I don't think I can help you." For a moment, she didn't let go of the window. But then her finger slipped away, and without another word, I drove off into the night. I never thought much about it again, at least not until later. The more I thought about it, the more I wondered if she was in some kind of trouble or if it was a trap. I'll never know what was going on with that girl, but I don't think I'll ever forget her eyes. and the way she just stood there in the rain, staring at me like I wasn't even there. I grew up in a New England suburb, a huge colonial house over 150 years old. As a kid, I used to get creeped out sometimes, especially late at night. I have 5 siblings, so luckily it was rare for me to be home alone. Shortly after college though, my mom and I were the only 2 living in our home together. My 3 older siblings were married or engaged, and the 2 younger ones were in college. My bedroom at the time was on the 3rd floor, directly in the center of the house, aligned with the walkway leading to the front door. My mom's bedroom was 1 floor below. One night, as I was sleeping, it began pouring rain. No thunder or lightning, just heavy rain and strong wind. The sound woke me up, and I recall lying there staring at the ceiling and listening to the storm. Then I distinctly heard what sounded like someone walking slowly outside in hard-bottom shoes. Initially, I wasn't sure because the sound of the wind and rain was so loud that I didn't think it was possible for footsteps to be loud enough to be audible, especially from the 3rd floor. But the sound was becoming louder and clearer as though the person was getting nearer to my house. Not only could I hear footsteps, but the person was also whistling. I felt compelled to look out the window, but for some strange reason, I felt afraid. So I leaned out of bed and parted the blinds a tiny bit, just enough to peek through with one eye. Sure enough, there was a tall figure maybe a block away walking towards my house. It was a man dressed in a trench coat and dress shoes, but I couldn't see him from the waist up because he was under a large umbrella. As he approached my house, which was to his right, I expected him to continue walking. But as soon as he got to our walkway, he stopped whistling and turned his body to face my house, as if he intended to walk up to the front door. But he just stood there. Then he tilted the umbrella back as if he was looking directly up to my window. I couldn't see his face because the black umbrella was casting a shadow. I was shocked and absolutely petrified, too scared to move. He stood there for maybe 30 seconds, then lowered his umbrella to a normal level. Then he turned back in the direction he had been walking, started whistling again, and walked away. I slowly laid back in my bed, waited until I couldn't hear his footsteps or whistling anymore, then bolted downstairs to my mom's room. That stranger walking outside on a stormy night scared me so much that I asked to sleep in my mom's room with her, even though I was 21 years old at the time.